On Broad Street in the city of Philadelphia, there is a fruit shop where those who patronize the store are met at the door by a man in uniform who opens the door for them. He does nothing else but merely open the door, but he does it with a smile. This fruit merchant specializes in baskets of fruit decorated with fancy wrappings and ribbons. Just outside the store is a big blackboard on which are listed the sailing dates of the various ocean liners leaving New York City. This merchant caters to people who wish baskets of fruit delivered on board departing boats on which friends are sailing. This merchant's store is a small affair, no larger than the average small store, but he pays a rent of at least $15,000 a year for the place and makes more money than half a hundred ordinary fruit stands combined, merely because he knows how to display and deliver his wares so they appeal to the vanity of the buyers. He gets from $10 to $25 for a basket of fruit, which one could purchase just around the corner for from $3 to $7.50, with the exception that the latter would not be embellished with the 75 cents worth of frills which the former contains. This is but another proof of the value of imagination. The American people, and this means all of them, not merely the so-called rich, are the most extravagant spenders on earth, but they insist on class when it comes to appearances such as wrapping and delivery and other embellishments, which add no real value to the merchandise they buy. The merchant who understands this and has learned how to mix imagination with his merchandise may reap a rich harvest in return for his knowledge. And a great many are doing it, too. The salesman who understands the psychology of proper display, wrapping, and delivery of merchandise, and who knows how to share his wares to fit the whims and characteristics of his customers, can make ordinary merchandise bring fancy prices, and what is more important still, he can do so and still retain the patronage of his customers more readily than if he sold the same merchandise without the studied appeal and the artistic wrapping and delivery service. In a cheap restaurant where coffee is served in heavy, thick cups and the silverware is tarnished or dirty, a ham sandwich is only a ham sandwich, and if the restaurant keeper gets 15 cents for what he is doing well, but just across the street, where the coffee is served in dainty, thin cups, on neatly covered tables, a much smaller ham sandwich will bring a quarter, to say nothing of the cost of the tip for service. The only difference in sandwiches is merely in appearances. The difference in price is very considerable, but the difference in the merchandise is not a difference of either quality or quantity, so much as it is of atmosphere or appearance. People love to buy appearance or atmosphere, which is merely a more refined way of saying that which P.T. Barnum said about one being born every minute. It is no overstatement of fact to say that a master of sales psychology could go into the average merchant store, where the stock of goods was worth, let us say, $50,000, and at very slight additional expense, make the stock bring $60,000 to $75,000. He would do nothing except coach the salespeople on the proper showing of the merchandise, after having purchased a small amount of more suitable fixtures, perhaps, and repacked the merchandise in more suitable coverings and boxes. A shirt or blouse, packed one to a box, in the right sort of box, with a piece of ribbon and a sheet of tissue paper added for embellishment, can be made to bring a dollar or a dollar and a half more than the same shirt would bring without more artistic packing. I know this is true, and I have proved it more times than I can recall, to convince some skeptical merchant who had not studied the effect of proper displays. Conversely stated, I have proved many times that the finest shirt made cannot be sold for half its value if it is removed from its box and placed on a bargain counter with inferior-looking shirts. Editor's Commentary. As was noted at the beginning of this section, merchandising has changed radically in the years since Napoleon Hill wrote those words. But the basic principles he described are still at work in contemporary life. The editors are confident that if you stop to think about the last time you went into Starbucks or Walmart, bought a cell phone, a computer, a car, or just a pair of jeans at the Gap, you will recognize that you are being influenced by those same principles of imaginative salesmanship that Hill was writing about in 1927. The editors are equally confident that you too can take those old-fashioned concepts and use them in your own new-fashioned way. Continuing Napoleon Hill's original text. Lesson 7. Enthusiasm. You can do it if you believe you can. Enthusiasm is a state of mind that inspires and arouses one to put action into the task at hand. It does more than this. It is contagious and vitally affects not only the enthusiast, but all with whom he comes in contact. Enthusiasm bears the same relationship to a human being that steam does to the locomotive. It is the vital moving force that impels action. The greatest leaders are those who know how to inspire enthusiasm in their followers. Enthusiasm is the most important factor entering into salesmanship. It is, by far, the most vital factor that enters into public speaking. How enthusiasm will affect you. Mix enthusiasm with your work, and it will not seem hard or monotonous. Enthusiasm will so energize your entire body that you can get along with less than half the usual amount of sleep, and at the same time, it will enable you to perform from 2 to 3 times as much work as you usually perform in a given period without fatigue. For many years, I have done most of my writing at night. One night, while I was enthusiastically at work over my typewriter, I looked out of the window of my study just across the square from the Metropolitan Tower in New York City and saw what seemed to be the most peculiar reflection of the moon on the tower. It was of a silvery gray shade, such as I had never seen before. Upon closer inspection, I found that the reflection was that of the early morning sun and not that of the moon. It was daylight. I had been at work all night, but I was so engrossed in my work that the night had passed as though it were but an hour. I worked at my task all that day and all the following night without stopping, except for a small amount of light food. 2 nights and 1 day without sleep and with little food, without the slightest evidence of fatigue, would not have been possible had I not kept my body energized with enthusiasm over the work at hand. Enthusiasm is not merely a figure of speech. It is a vital force that you can harness and use. Without it, you would resemble an electric battery without electricity. Enthusiasm is the vital force with which you recharge your body and develop a dynamic personality. Some people are blessed with natural enthusiasm, while others must acquire it. The procedure through which it may be developed is simple. It begins by doing work you like. If you cannot engage in the work which you like best for the time being, then you can proceed along another line very effectively by adopting a definite chief aim that contemplates your engaging in that particular work at some future time. Lack of money and other circumstances over which you have no control may force you to engage in work which you do not like. But no one can stop you from determining in your own mind what your definite chief aim in life will be, nor can anyone stop you from planning ways and means for translating this aim into reality, nor can anyone stop you from mixing enthusiasm with your plans. Happiness, the final object of all human effort, is a state of mind that can be maintained only through the hope of future achievement. The happy person is the one who dreams of heights of achievement that are yet unattained. The home you intend to own. The money you intend to earn and place in the bank. The trip you intend to take when you can afford it. The position in life you intend to fill when you have prepared yourself and the preparation itself. These are the things that produce happiness. Likewise, these are the materials out of which your definite chief aim is formed. These are the things over which you may become enthusiastic, no matter what your present station in life may be. More than 20 years ago, I became enthusiastic over an idea. When the idea first took form in my mind, I was unprepared to take even the first step towards its transformation into reality. But I nursed it in my mind. I became enthusiastic over it as I looked ahead in my imagination and saw the time when I would be prepared to make it a reality. The idea was this. I wanted to become the editor of a magazine based upon the Golden Rule, through which I could inspire people to keep up courage and deal with one another squarely. Finally, my chance came, and on Armistice Day, 1918, I wrote the first editorial for what was to become the material realization of a hope that had lain dormant in my mind for nearly 20 years. With enthusiasm, I poured into that editorial the emotions which I had been developing in my heart. My dream had come true. My editorship of a national magazine had become a reality. As I have stated, this editorial was written with enthusiasm. I took it to a man of my acquaintance, and with enthusiasm, I read it to him. The editorial ended in these words. At last, my 20-year-old dream is about to come true. It takes money, and a lot of it, to publish a national magazine. And I haven't the slightest idea where I'm going to get this essential factor. But this is worrying me not at all, because I know I'm going to get it somewhere. As I wrote those lines, I had hardly finished reading this editorial when the man to whom I read it, the first and only person to whom I had shown it, said, I can tell you where you're going to get that money, or I am going to supply it. And he did. Yes, enthusiasm is a vital force, so vital, in fact, that no one who has it highly developed can begin to even approximate his power of achievement. Before passing to the next step in this lesson, I wish to repeat and to emphasize the fact that you may develop enthusiasm over your definite chief aim in life, no matter whether you are in position to achieve that purpose at this time or not. You may be a long way from your realization of your definite chief aim, but if you will kindle the fire of enthusiasm in your heart and keep it burning, before very long, the obstacles that now stand in the way of your attainment of that purpose will melt away as if by the force of magic, and you will find yourself in possession of power that you did not know you possessed. How Your Enthusiasm Will Affect Others. From the Editors. In Volume 1 of The Law of Success, The Principles of Self-Mastery, Napoleon Hill discusses at length the subject of autosuggestion, or self-suggestion, as well as another form of suggestion which he called the principle of telepathy. As noted earlier, in the time since Hill's writing, most experiments in telepathy have done little to convince the skeptical. What Hill meant by the term, however, had little to do with hocus-pocus and much to do with common sense. Here, he briefly recaps his thoughts on telepathy as it relates to suggestion. Now back to Napoleon Hill's original text. We come now to the discussion of one of the most important subjects of this course, namely suggestion. Suggestion is the principle through which your words and your acts and even your state of mind influence others. If you accept the principle of telepathy, the communication of thought from one mind to another without the aid of signs, symbols, or sounds, as a reality, you of course understand why enthusiasm is contagious and why it influences all within its radius. When your own mind is vibrating at a high rate because it has been stimulated with enthusiasm, that vibration registers in the minds of all within its radius, and especially in the minds of those with whom you come in close contact. When a public speaker senses the feeling that his audience is en rapport, or in harmony with him, he merely recognizes the fact that his own enthusiasm has influenced the minds of his listeners until their minds are vibrating in harmony with his own. When the salesman senses the fact that the psychological moment for closing a sale has arrived, he merely feels the effect of his own enthusiasm as it influences the mind of his prospective buyer and places that mind en rapport with his own. The subject of suggestion constitutes so vitally an important part of this lesson and of this entire course that I will describe the three mediums through which it usually operates, namely what you say, what you do, and what you think. When you are enthusiastic over the goods you are selling or the services you are offering, or the speech you are delivering, your state of mind becomes obvious to all who hear you by the tone of your voice. Whether you have ever thought of it in this way or not, it is the tone in which you make a statement, more than it is the statement itself, that carries conviction or fails to convince. No mere combination of words can ever take the place of a deep belief in a statement that is expressed with burning enthusiasm. Words are but devitalized sounds unless colored with feeling that is born of enthusiasm. Here, the printed word fails me, for I can never express with mere type and paper the difference between words that fall from unemotional lips without the fire of enthusiasm back of them, and those which seem to pour forth from the heart that is bursting with eagerness for expression. The difference is there, however. Thus, what you say, and the way in which you say it, conveys a meaning that may be just the opposite to what is intended. This accounts for many a failure by the salesman who presents his arguments in words which seem logical enough, but lack the coloring that can come only from enthusiasm that is born of sincerity and belief in the goods he is trying to sell. His words said one thing, but the tone of his voice suggested something entirely different. Therefore, no sale was made. That which you say is an important factor in the operation of the principle of suggestion, but not nearly so important as that which you do. Your acts will count for more than your words, and woe unto you if the two fail to harmonize. If you preach the golden rule as a sound rule of conduct, your words will fall upon deaf ears if you do not practice what you preach. The most effective sermon that a person can preach on the soundness of the golden rule is the one that is preached by suggestion, when that person applies this rule in relationships with others. If a salesman of Ford automobiles drives up to his prospective purchaser in a Buick, all the arguments he can present in behalf of the Ford will be without effect. Your thoughts constitute the most important of the three ways in which you apply the principle of suggestion, for the reason that they control the tone of your words and, to some extent at least, your actions. If your thoughts and your actions and your words harmonize, you are bound to influence others. We will now proceed to analyze the subject of suggestion and to show you exactly how to apply the principle upon which it operates. As we have already seen, suggestion differs from autosuggestion only in one way. We use suggestion, consciously or unconsciously, when we influence others, while we use autosuggestion as a means of influencing ourselves. Before you can influence another person through suggestion, that person's mind must be in a state of neutrality, that is, it must be open and receptive to your method of suggestion. Right here is where most salespeople fail. They try to make a sale before the mind of the prospective buyer has been rendered receptive or neutralized. This is such a vital point in this lesson that I feel impelled to dwell upon it until there can be no doubt that you understand the principle that I'm describing. When I say that the salesperson must neutralize the mind of the prospective purchaser before a sale can be made, I mean that the prospective purchaser's mind must be credulous. A state of confidence must have been established, and it is obvious that there can be no set rule for either establishing confidence or neutralizing the mind to a state of openness. Here, the ingenuity of the salesperson must apply that which cannot be set down as a hard and fast rule. I know a life insurance salesman who sells nothing but large policies. Before this man even approaches the subject of insurance with a prospective client, he familiarizes himself with the prospective client's complete history, including his education, his financial status, his eccentricities, if he has any, his religious preferences, and other data too numerous to be listed. Armed with this information, he manages to secure an introduction under conditions that permit him to know the prospective client in a social as well as a business way. Nothing is said about the sale of life insurance during his first visit, nor his second, and sometimes he does not approach the subject of insurance until he's become very well acquainted with the prospective client. All this time, however, he's not dissipating his efforts. He is taking advantage of these friendly visits for the purpose of neutralizing his prospective client's mind. That is, he is building up a relationship of confidence so that when the time comes for him to talk life insurance, that which he says will fall upon ears that willingly listen. Some years ago, I wrote a book entitled How to Sell Your Services. Just before the manuscript went to the publisher, it occurred to me to request some celebrities to write letters of endorsement to be published in the book. The printer was then waiting for the manuscript. Therefore, I hurriedly wrote a letter to some 8 or 10 people in which I briefly outlined exactly what I wanted, but the letter brought back no replies. I had failed to observe two important prerequisites for success. I had written the letter so hurriedly that I failed to inject the spirit of enthusiasm into it, and I had neglected to word the letter so that it had the effect of neutralizing the minds of those to whom it was sent. I had not paved the way for the application of the principle of suggestion. After I discovered my mistake, I then wrote a letter that was based upon strict application of the principle of suggestion. And this letter not only brought back replies from all to whom it was sent, but many of the replies were masterpieces and served far beyond my fondest hopes as valuable supplements to the book. For the purpose of comparison, to show you how the principle of suggestion may be used in writing a letter, and what an important part enthusiasm plays in giving the written word flesh, the two letters are here reproduced. It will not be necessary to indicate which letter failed, as that will be quite obvious. My dear Mr. Ford, I am just completing a manuscript for a new book entitled How to Sell Your Services. I anticipate the sale of several hundred thousand of these books, and I believe those who purchase the book would welcome the opportunity of receiving a message from you as to the best method of marketing personal services. Would you, therefore, be good enough to give me a few minutes of your time by writing a brief message to be published in my book? This will be a big favor to me personally, and I know it would be appreciated by the readers of the book. Thank you in advance for any consideration you may care to show me. I am yours very truly. And this is the second letter. To the Honorable Thomas R. Marshall, Vice President of the United States, Washington, D.C. My dear Mr. Marshall, would you care for the opportunity to send a message of encouragement and possibly a word of advice to a few hundred thousand of your fellow men who have failed to make their mark in the world as successfully as you have done? I have completed a manuscript for a book to be entitled How to Sell Your Services, The main point made in the book is that service rendered is cause and the pay envelope is effect, and that the latter varies in proportion to the efficiency of the former. The book would be incomplete without a few words of advice from a few men who, like yourself, have come up from the bottom to enviable positions in the world. Therefore, if you will write me of your views as to the most essential points to be borne in mind by those who are offering personal services for sale, I will pass your message on through my book, which will ensure its getting into hands where it will do a world of good for a class of earnest people who are struggling to find their places in the world's work. I know you're a busy man, Mr. Marshall, but please bear in mind that by simply calling in your secretary and dictating a brief letter, you will be sending forth an important message to possibly 500,000 people. In money, this will not be worth to you the 2-cent stamp that you will place on the letter, but if estimated from the viewpoint of the good it may do others who are less fortunate than yourself, it may be worth the difference between success and failure to many a worthy person who will read your message, believe in it, and be guided by it. Very cordially yours. Now, let us analyze the two letters and find out why one failed in its mission while the other succeeded. This analysis should start with one of the most important fundamentals of salesmanship, namely, motive. In the first letter, it is obvious that the motive is entirely one of self-interest. The letter states exactly what is wanted, but the wording of it leaves a doubt as to why the request is made or whom it is intended to benefit. Study the sentence in the second paragraph. This will be a big favor to me personally, etc. Now, it may seem to be a peculiar trait, but the truth is that most people will not grant favors just to please others. If I ask you to render a service that will benefit me without bringing you some corresponding advantage, you will not show much enthusiasm in granting that favor. You may refuse altogether if you have a plausible excuse for refusing. But if I ask you to render a service that will benefit a third person, even though the service must be rendered through me, and if that service is of such a nature that it is likely to reflect credit on you, the chances are that you will render the service willingly. We see this psychology demonstrated by the person who gives only small change to the beggar on the street, but willingly hands over hundreds of thousands of dollars to the charity worker who is soliciting in the name of others. But the most damaging suggestion of all is contained in the last and most important paragraph of the letter, thanking you in advance for any consideration you may care to show me. This sentence strongly suggests that the writer of the letter anticipates a refusal of his request. It clearly indicates lack of enthusiasm. It paves the way for a refusal of the request. There is not one single word in the entire letter that places in the mind of anyone to whom it is sent a satisfactory reason for complying with the request. On the other hand, the reader can clearly see that the object of the letter is to secure a letter of endorsement that will help sell the book. The most important selling argument, in fact, the only selling argument in connection with this request, has been lost because it was not brought out and established as the real motive for making the request. This argument was faintly mentioned in the sentence, "I believe those who purchased the book would welcome the opportunity of receiving a message from you as to the best method of marketing personal services." The opening paragraph of the letter violates an important fundamental of salesmanship, because it clearly suggests that the object of the letter is to gain some advantage for its writer and does not even hint at any advantage to the person to whom it is sent. Instead of neutralizing the mind of the recipient of the letter, as it should do, it has just the opposite effect. It makes it easy for him to say no. It reminds me of a salesman, or perhaps I should say someone who wanted to be a salesman, who once approached me for the purpose of selling me a subscription to the Saturday Evening Post. As he held a copy of the magazine in front of me, he suggested the answer I should make by this question. "You wouldn't subscribe for the Post to help me out, would you?" He had made it too easy for me to say no. There was no enthusiasm back of his words, and he suggested nothing that appealed to my self-interest motive. Therefore, he lost a sale. A few weeks later, another subscription agent approached me. She was selling a combination of 6 magazines, one of which was the Saturday Evening Post. But how different was her approach? She glanced at my library table, on which she saw several magazines, then at my bookshelves, and exclaimed with enthusiasm, "Oh, I see you're a lover of books and magazines." I proudly pleaded guilty to the charge. Observe the word proudly, for it has an important bearing on this incident. I laid down the manuscript that I was reading when this saleswoman came in, for I could see that she was a woman of intelligence. Just how I came to see this, I will leave to your imagination. The important point is that I laid down the manuscript and actually felt myself wanting to hear what she had to say. With the aid of 11 words, plus a pleasant smile, plus a tone of genuine enthusiasm, she had neutralized my mind sufficiently to make me want to hear her. She had performed her most difficult task, with those few words, because I had made up my mind when she was announced that I would keep my manuscript in my hands and thereby convey to her mind, as politely as I could, the fact that I was busy. Being a student of salesmanship and of suggestion, I carefully watched to see what her next move would be. She had a bundle of magazines under her arm, and I expected she would unroll it and begin to urge me to purchase, but she didn't. You will recall that I said she was selling a combination of 6 magazines, not merely trying to sell them. She walked over to my bookshelves, pulled out a copy of Emerson's Essays, and for the next 10 minutes, she talked about Emerson's essay on compensation so interestingly that I lost sight of the roll of magazines that she carried. She was neutralizing my mind some more. Incidentally, she gave me a sufficient number of new ideas about Emerson's works to provide material for an excellent editorial. Then she asked me which magazines I received regularly, and after I told her, she smiled as she began to unroll her bundle of magazines and laid them on the table in front of me. She analyzed her magazines one by one and explained just why I should have each of them. The Saturday Evening Post would bring me the cleanest fiction. Literary Digest would bring me the news of the world in condensed form, such as a busy man like myself would demand. The American Magazine would bring me the latest biographies of those who were leading in business and industry, and so on, until she had covered the entire list. But I was not responding to her argument as freely as she thought I should have, so she slipped me this gentle suggestion. A man of your position is bound to be well informed, and if he isn't, it will show up in his own. She spoke the truth. Her remark was both a compliment and a gentle reprimand. She made me feel somewhat sheepish because she had taken inventory of my reading matter, and 6 of the leading magazines were not on my list, the 6 that she was selling. Then I began to slip by asking her how much the magazines would cost. She put on the finishing touches of a well-presented sales talk by this tactful reply. The cost? Why, the cost of the entire number is less than you receive for a single page of the typewritten manuscript that you had in your hands when I came in. Again, she spoke the truth. And how did she happen to guess so well what I was getting for my manuscript? The answer is, she didn't guess. She knew. She made it a part of her business to draw me out tactfully as to the nature of my work, which in no way made me angry. She became so deeply interested in the manuscript, which I had laid down when she came in, that she actually induced me to talk about it. I'm not saying, of course, that this required any great amount of skill or coaxing. After all, it was my manuscript. For all I know, it was part of her plan to observe carefully all that she saw and heard, with the object of finding out just what my weaknesses were and what I was most interested in discussing. Some salesmen take the time to do this, some do not. She was one of those who did. Yes, she went away with my order for the 6 magazines. But that was not all the benefit she derived from tactful suggestion plus enthusiasm. She got my consent to canvass my office, and before she left, she had 5 other orders from my employees. At no time during her stay did she leave the impression that I was favoring her by purchasing her magazines. Just to the contrary, she distinctly impressed me with the feeling that she was rendering me a favor. This was tactful suggestion. Before we get away from this incident, I wish to make an admission. When she drew me into conversation, she did it in such a way that I talked with enthusiasm. I'm sure I caught the spirit of enthusiasm from this clever saleswoman when she made that opening remark as she came into my study. And I'm just as sure that her enthusiasm was not a matter of accident. She had trained herself to look for something in her prospective purchaser's office, or his work, or his conversation, over which she could express enthusiasm. Remember, suggestion and enthusiasm go hand in hand. I can remember, as though it were yesterday, the feeling that came over me when that other would-be salesman pushed that Saturday Evening Post in front of me as he remarked, "You wouldn't subscribe to the Post to help me out, would you?" His words were chilled, they were lifeless, they lacked enthusiasm. They registered an impression in my mind, but that impression was one of coldness. I wanted to see the man go out at the door at which he had come in. Mind you, I'm not naturally unsympathetic, but the tone of his voice, the look on his face, his general bearing suggested that he was there to ask a favor and not to offer one. Suggestion is one of the most subtle and powerful principles of psychology. You are making use of it in all that you do and say and think, but unless you understand the difference between negative suggestion and positive suggestion, you may be using it in such a way that it is bringing you defeat instead of success. Science has established the fact that through the negative use of suggestion, life may be extinguished. In the little town where I was raised, there lived an old lady who constantly complained that she feared death from cancer. During her childhood, she had seen a woman who had cancer, and the sight had so impressed itself upon her mind that she began to look for symptoms in her own body. She was sure that every little ache and pain was the beginning of her long-looked-for symptom of cancer. I have seen her place her hand on her breast and have heard her exclaim, "Oh, I am sure I have a cancer growing here. I can feel it," when complaining of this left breast where she believed the cancer was attacking her. A few weeks ago, she died with cancer on her left breast. If suggestion will actually transform healthy body cells into parasites out of which cancer will develop, can you not imagine what it will do in destroying disease germs if properly directed? Suggestion is the law through which mental healers work what appear to be miracles. I have personally witnessed the removal of parasitical growths known as warts through the aid of suggestion within 48 hours. Editor's Commentary. By the 1980s, the medical aspects of the principle that Napoleon Hill wrote about in the preceding paragraph was embraced by a growing segment of the population commonly referred to as the New Age. Among the adherents were numerous medical professionals who incorporated the concept under the term the body-mind connection. And by the turn of the 21st century, the belief that the mind can manifest physical changes in the body had become part of mainstream medical practice. Following is a listing of the seminal books and audiobooks that explain in greater detail the medical applications of the power of suggestion. Visualization by Adelaide Bry. Ageless Body, Timeless Mind by Deepak Chopra, MD. Creative Visualization by Shakti Gawain. Focusing by Eugene Gendlin, PhD. You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay. Healing with Body Energy by W. Brew Joy, M.D. Psycho-Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz, M.D. Superimmunity by Paul Pearsall, Ph.D. Healing Back Pain by John E. Sarno, M.D. Love, Medicine, and Miracles by Bernie S. Siegel, M.D. Getting Well by O. Carl Simonton, M.D. 8 Weeks to Optimum Health and Spontaneous Healing by Andrew Weil, M.D. Continuing with Napoleon Hill's original text. A few months ago, I received one of the most effective pieces of advertising I ever saw. It was a neat little book in which a clever automobile insurance salesman had reprinted press dispatches that he had gathered from all over the country, in which it was shown that 65 automobiles had been stolen in a single day. On the back page of the book was this highly suggestive statement. Your car may be the next one to go. Is it insured? At the bottom of the page was the salesman's name and address, also his telephone number. Before I had finished reading the first 2 pages of the book, I called the salesman on the telephone and made inquiry about rates. He came right over to see me, and you know the remainder of the story. Think back now to the 2 letters, and let us analyze the second one, which brought the desired replies from all to whom it was sent. Study carefully the first paragraph, and you will observe that it asks a question that can be answered in but one way. Compare this opening paragraph with that of the first letter by asking yourself which of the two would have impressed you most favorably. This paragraph is worded as it is for a twofold purpose. First, it is intended to serve the purpose of neutralizing the mind of the reader, so he will read the remainder of the letter in an open-minded attitude. And, second, it asks a question which can be answered in but one way, for the purpose of committing the reader to a viewpoint which harmonizes with the nature of the service that he is to be requested to render in subsequent paragraphs of the letter. In the second lesson of this course, you observe that Andrew Carnegie refused to answer my question when I asked him what he attributed to a success, until he asked me to define the word success. He did this to avoid misunderstanding. The first paragraph of the letter we are analyzing is so worded that it states the object of the letter and at the same time practically forces the reader to accept that object as being sound and reasonable. Any person who would answer the question in the negative would convict himself on the charge of selfishness, and no one wants to live with a guilty conscience on such a charge. Just as the farmer first plows his ground, then fertilizes it in order that he may be sure of a crop, so does this paragraph fertilize the mind of the reader and prepare it for the seed which is to be placed there through the subtle suggestion that the paragraph contains. Study carefully the second paragraph of the letter, and you will observe that it carries a statement of fact that the reader can neither question nor deny. It provides him with no reason for argument, because it is obviously based upon a sound fundamental. It takes him the second step of the psychological journey that leads straight toward compliance with a request that is carefully clothed and covered up in the third paragraph of the letter. But you will notice that the third paragraph begins by paying the reader a nice little compliment that was not designed to make him angry. Quote, "Therefore, if you will write me of your views as to the most essential points to be borne in mind by those who are offering personal services for sale," end quote, etc., study the wording of this sentence, together with the setting in which it has been placed, and you will observe that it hardly appears to be a request at all. And certainly there is nothing about it to suggest that the writer of the letter is requesting a favor for his personal benefit. At most, it can be construed merely as a request for a favor for others. Now study the closing paragraph, and notice how tactfully concealed is the suggestion that if the reader should refuse the request, he is placing himself in the awkward position of one who does not care enough about those who are less fortunate than himself to spend a stamp and a few minutes of time for their benefit. The whole construction of the letter is such that if the reader lays it aside without complying with the request it makes, he will have to reckon with his own conscience. This effect is intensified by the last sentence of the last paragraph, and especially by the last 13 words of that sentence. Quote, "Who will read your message, believe in it, and be guided by it?" End quote. This letter brings the reader up with a bang and turns his own conscience into an ally of the writer. It corners him, just as a hunter might corner a rabbit by driving it into a carefully prepared net. The best evidence that this analysis is correct is the fact that the letter brought replies from every person to whom it was sent, despite the fact that every one of those recipients was of the type that is generally supposed to be too busy to answer a letter of this nature. Not only did the letter bring the desired replies, but those to whom it was sent replied in person, with the exception of the late Theodore Roosevelt, who replied under the signature of a secretary. John Wanamaker and Frank A. Vanderlip wrote two of the finest letters I have ever read, each a masterpiece that might well have adorned the pages of a more dignified volume than the one for which the letters were requested. Andrew Carnegie also wrote a letter that was well worth consideration by all who have personal services for sale. William Jennings Bryan wrote a fine letter, as did also the late Lord Northcliffe. None of these wrote merely to please me, for I was unknown to all of them, with the exception of four. They did not write to please me, they wrote to please themselves and to render a worthy service. Perhaps the wording of the letter had something to do with this, but, as to that, I make no point other than to state that all of those whom I've mentioned, and most others of their type, are generally the most willing to render service for others when they are properly approached. I wish to take advantage of this appropriate opportunity to state that all of the really big public figures whom I've had the pleasure of knowing have been the most willing and courteous men of my acquaintance when it came to rendering service that was of benefit to others. Perhaps that was the reason why they were really major figures. The human mind is a marvelous piece of machinery. One of its outstanding characteristics is noticed in the fact that all impressions which reach it, either through outside suggestion or auto-suggestion, are recorded together in groups which harmonize in nature. The negative impressions are stored away, all in one portion of the brain, while the positive impressions are stored in another portion. When one of these impressions, or past experiences, is called into the conscious mind, through the principle of memory, there is a tendency to recall with it all others of a similar nature, just as the raising of one link of a chain brings up other links with it. For example, anything that causes a feeling of doubt to arise in a person's mind is sufficient to call forth all of his experiences which caused him to become doubtful. If a person is asked by a stranger to cash a check, he or she immediately remembers having cashed checks that were not good, or of having heard of others who did so. Through the law of association, all similar emotions, experiences, and sense impressions that reach the mind are filed away together, so that the recalling of one has a tendency to bring back to memory all the others. To arouse a feeling of distrust in a person's mind has a tendency to bring to the surface every doubt-building experience that person ever had. For this reason, successful salespeople endeavor to keep away from the discussion of subjects that may arouse the buyer's chain of doubt impressions from previous experiences. The successful salesman quickly learns that knocking a competitor may result in bringing to the buyer's mind certain negative emotions, which may make it impossible for the salesman to neutralize the buyer's mind. This principle applies to and controls every sense impression that is lodged in the human mind. Take the feeling of fear, for example. The moment we permit a single emotion that is related to fear to reach the conscious mind, it calls with it all of its unsavory relations. A feeling of courage cannot claim the attention of the conscious mind while a feeling of fear is there. One or the other must dominate. They make poor roommates because they do not harmonize in nature. Like attracts like. Every thought held in the conscious mind has a tendency to draw to it other thoughts of a similar nature. These feelings, thoughts, and emotions growing out of past experiences which claim the attention of the conscious mind are backed by a regular army of supporting soldiers of a similar nature that stand ready to aid them in their work. The editor's comment. As noted earlier, many people built on the basic principles about which Napoleon Hill wrote and lectured. Some took inspiration from Hill's principles of success and turned their inspiration into businesses, a number of which went on to become not just businesses, but industries unto themselves. Others built on the ideas by elaborating on certain concepts, and they themselves became best-selling authors and famous motivational speakers. To experience firsthand just how influential Napoleon Hill has been in this regard, the editors urge you to attend seminars and workshops by today's popular speakers. You will hear new buzzwords, and the speakers will illustrate their concepts with contemporary stories. But behind each modern catchphrase or story, you will also hear the echo of one of Hill's original 17 principles of success. Two of the most prominent and powerful motivational speakers of the latter part of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century are Anthony Robbins and Stephen Covey, both of whom readily acknowledge Napoleon Hill as a major inspiration in their work. Returning to Napoleon Hill's original text. Enthusiasm and suggestion. Deliberately place in your own mind, through the principle of autosuggestion, the ambition to succeed through the aid of a definite chief aim, and notice how quickly all of your latent or undeveloped ability in the nature of past experiences will become stimulated and aroused to action in your behalf. Plant in a child's mind, through the principle of suggestion, the ambition to become a successful lawyer or doctor or engineer or businessman or financier. And if you plant that suggestion deeply enough and keep it there by repetition, it will begin to move that child toward the achievement of the object of that ambition. If you would plant a suggestion deeply, mix it generously with enthusiasm, for enthusiasm is the fertilizer that will ensure its rapid growth as well as its permanency. When a kind-hearted old gentleman planted in my mind the suggestion that I was a bright boy and that I could make my mark in the world if I would educate myself, it was not so much what he said, as it was the way in which he said it that made such a deep and lasting impression on my mind. It was the way in which he gripped my shoulders and the look of confidence in his eyes that drove his suggestion so deeply into my subconscious mind that it never gave me any peace until I commenced taking the steps that led to the fulfillment of the suggestion. This is a point that I would stress with all the power at my command. It is not so much what you say as it is the tone and the manner in which you say it that makes a lasting impression. It naturally follows, therefore, that sincerity of purpose, honesty, and earnestness must be placed back of all that one says if one would make a lasting and favorable impression. Whatever you successfully sell to others, you must first sell to yourself. Not long ago, I was approached by an agent of the government of a certain country. The agent sought my services as a writer of propaganda for the administration in charge at that time. His approach was about as follows. Whereas you have a reputation as an exponent of the Golden Rule philosophy, and whereas you are known throughout the United States as an independent who is not allied with any political faction, would you be gracious enough to come to our country, study the economic and political affairs, then return to the United States and write a series of articles to appear in the newspapers recommending to the people of America the immediate recognition of our government by the United States, etc. For this service, I was offered more money than I shall perhaps ever possess during my entire life, but I refused the commission, and for a reason that will fail to impress anyone except those who understand the principle which makes it necessary for all who would influence others to remain on good terms with their own conscience. I could not write convincingly of that country's cause for the reason that I did not believe in that cause. Therefore, I could not have mixed sufficient enthusiasm with my writing to have made it effective, even though I had been willing to prostitute my talent and dip my pen into ink that I believed to be muddy. I will not endeavor further to explain my philosophy on this incident, for the reason that those who are far enough advanced in the study of autosuggestion will not need further explanation, while those who are not far enough advanced would not and could not understand. No one can afford to express, through words or acts, that which is not in harmony with his own belief, and if he does so, he must pay by the loss of his ability to influence others. The foregoing paragraph is worth emphasizing by repetition, for lack of observation of the principle upon which it is based constitutes the rocks and reefs upon which many a person's definite chief aim dashes itself into pieces. So, once again, no one can afford to express, through words or acts, that which is not in harmony with his own belief, and if he does so, he must pay by the loss of his ability to influence others. I do not believe that I can afford to try to deceive anyone about anything, but I know that I cannot afford to try to deceive myself. To do so would destroy the power of my pen and render my words ineffective. It is only when I write with the fire of enthusiasm burning in my heart that my writing impresses others favorably. And it is only when I speak from a heart that is bursting with belief in my message that I can move my audience to accept that message. I urge you to commit that paragraph to memory. Write it out and place it where it may serve as a daily reminder of a principle, as immutable as the law of gravity, without which you can never become a power in your chosen life work. There have been times, and many of them, when it appeared that if I stood by this principle, it would mean starvation. There have been times when my closest friends and business advisors have strongly urged me to shade my philosophy for the sake of gaining a needed advantage here and there. But somehow, I have managed to cling to it, mainly, I suppose, for the reason that I have preferred peace and harmony in my own heart to the material gain that I might have had by compromising my integrity. Strange as it may seem, my refusal to strangle my own conscience has seldom been based upon what is commonly called honesty. My refusal to write or speak anything that I did not believe has been solely a question of honor between my conscience and myself. I have tried to express that which my heart dictated because I have aimed to give my words flesh. It might be said that my motive was based more upon self-interest than it was on a desire to be fair with others, although I have never desired to be unfair with others, so far as I am able to analyze myself. No one can become a master salesman if he compromises falsehood, even though no one ever catches him red-handed in expressing that which he does not believe. His words will fail in the accomplishment of their purpose because he cannot give them flesh if they do not come from his heart, and if they are not mixed with genuine, unadulterated enthusiasm. The foregoing paragraph embraces a great law that you must understand and apply before you can become a person of influence in any undertaking. I should point out that I am quite serious when I ask you to memorize certain phrases. It is not that I don't give you full credit for being an adult, a thinker, an intelligent person, but I know how likely you are to skip over these vital laws without being sufficiently impressed by them to make them a part of your own workaday philosophy. I know your weakness because I know my own. It has required the better part of 25 years of ups and downs, mostly downs, to impress these basic truths upon my own mind so that they influenced me. I have tried both them and their opposites. Therefore, I can speak not as one who merely believes in their soundness, but as one who knows. And what do I mean by these truths? So that you cannot possibly misunderstand my meaning, and so that these words of warning cannot possibly convey an abstract meaning, I will state that by these truths, I mean this. You cannot afford to suggest to another person, by word of mouth or by an act of yours, that which you do not believe. Surely that is plain enough. And the reason you cannot afford to do so is this. If you compromise with your own conscience, it will not be long before you will have no conscience. For your conscience will fail to guide you, just as an alarm clock will fail to awaken you if you do not heed it. Surely that is plain enough also. And how do I happen to be an authority on this vital subject? I am an authority because I have experimented with the principle until I know how it works. But you may ask, how do I know that you're telling the truth? The answer is that you will know only by experimenting for yourself and by observing others who faithfully apply this principle and those who do not apply it. If my evidence needs backing, then consult anyone whom you know to be a person who has tried to get by without observing this principle, and if he will not or cannot give you the truth, you can get it nevertheless by analyzing the character of the person. There is but one thing in the world that gives us real and enduring power, and that is character. Reputation is that which people are believed to be. Character is that which people are. If you would be a person of great influence, then be a person of real character. Character is the philosopher's lodestone through which all who have it may turn the base metals of their life into pure gold. Without character, you have nothing, you are nothing, and you can be nothing. Character is something that you cannot beg or steal or buy. You can only get it by building it, and you can build it by your own thoughts and deeds, and in no other way. Through the aid of autosuggestion, any person can build a sound character, no matter what his past has been. As a fitting close for this lesson, I wish to emphasize the fact that all who have character have enthusiasm and personality sufficient to attract others who have character. Following are three simple but valuable instructions about how to develop enthusiasm. First, complete the remaining lessons of this course, because other important instructions which are to be coordinated with this one will be found in subsequent lessons. Second, if you have not already done so, write out your definite chief aim in clear, simple language, and follow this by writing out the plan through which you intend to transform your aim into reality. Third, read over the description of your definite chief aim each night just before retiring, and as you read, see yourself, in your imagination, in full possession of the object of your aim. Do this with full faith in your ability to transform your definite chief aim into reality. Read aloud with all the enthusiasm at your command, emphasizing every word. Repeat this reading until the small, still voice within you tells you that your purpose will be realized. Sometimes you will feel the effects of this voice from within the first time you read your definite chief aim. You may have to read it a dozen or 50 times before the assurance comes, but do not stop until you feel it. One of the greatest powers for good upon the face of this earth is faith. To this marvelous power may be traced miracles of the most astounding nature. It offers peace on earth to all who embrace it. Faith involves a principle that is so far-reaching in its effect that no one can say what are its limitations or if it has limitations. Write into the description of your definite chief aim a statement of the qualities that you intend to develop in yourself and the station in life that you intend to attain, and have faith as you read this description each night that you can transform this purpose into reality. Surely you cannot miss the suggestion contained in this lesson. To become successful, you must be a person of action. Merely to know is not sufficient. It is necessary both to know and do. Enthusiasm is the mainspring of the mind that urges one to put knowledge into action. Billy Sunday is the most successful evangelist this country has ever known. For the purpose of studying his technique and checking up on his psychological methods, I went through three campaigns with Reverend Sunday. His success is based very largely upon one word, enthusiasm. By making effective use of the law of suggestion, Billy Sunday conveys his own spirit of enthusiasm to the minds of his followers, and they become influenced by it. He sells his sermons by the use of exactly the same sort of strategy employed by many master salespeople. Enthusiasm is as essential to a salesman as water is to a duck. All successful sales managers understand the psychology of enthusiasm and make use of it in various ways as a practical means of helping their group produce more sales. Practically all sales organizations have get-together meetings for the purpose of revitalizing the minds of all members of the sales force and injecting the spirit of enthusiasm, which can be best done en masse through group psychology. Sales meetings might properly be called revival meetings because their purpose is to revive interest and arouse enthusiasm that will enable the salesman to take up the fight with renewed ambition and energy. During his administration as sales manager of the National Cash Register Company, Hugh Chalmers, who later became famous in the motor car industry, faced a most embarrassing situation which threatened to wipe out his position as well as that of thousands of salesmen under his direction. The company was in financial difficulty. This fact had become known to the salesmen in the field, and the effect of it was to cause them to lose their enthusiasm. Sales began to dwindle until finally the conditions became so alarming that a general meeting of the sales organization was called, to be held at the company's plant in Dayton, Ohio. Salesmen were called in from all over the country. Mr. Chalmers presided over the meeting. He began by calling on several of his best salespeople to get on their feet and tell what was wrong out in the field that orders had fallen off. One by one, they got up, as called, and each one had a most terrible tale of grief to unfold. Business conditions were bad, money was scarce, people were holding off buying until after the presidential election, and so forth. As the fifth man began to enumerate the difficulties which had kept him from making his usual quota of sales, Mr. Chalmers jumped on top of a table, held up his hands for silence, and said, "Stop! I order this convention to come to a close for 10 minutes while I get my shoes shined." Then, turning to a small boy who sat nearby, he ordered the boy to bring his shoeshine outfit and shine his shoes. Right where he stood, on top of the salesmen in the audience were astounded. They began to whisper among themselves. Meanwhile, the boy shined first one and then the other shoe, taking plenty of time and doing a first-class job. After the job was finished, Mr. Chalmers handed the boy a dime, then went ahead with his speech. "I want each of you," said he, "to take a good look at this boy. He has the concession for shoe shining throughout our plant and offices. His predecessor was considerably older than himself, and despite the fact that the company subsidized him with a salary, he could not make a living in this plant where thousands of people are employed. This boy not only makes a good living without any subsidy from the company, but he is actually saving money out of his earnings each week, working under the same conditions, in the same plant, for the same people. Now I wish to ask you a question. Whose fault was it that the older boy did not get more business? Was it his fault, or the fault of his buyers?" In a mighty roar from the crowd, the answer came back, "It was the boy's fault, of course." "Just so," replied Chalmers. "And now I want to tell you this, that you are selling cash registers in the same territory, to the same people, with exactly the same business conditions that existed a year ago. Yet you are not producing the business that you were then. Now whose fault is that? Is it yours or the buyer's?" And again the answer came back with a roar, "It is our fault, of course." "I am glad that you are frank to acknowledge your faults," Chalmers continued, "and I now wish to tell you what your trouble is. You have heard rumors about this company being in financial trouble, and that has killed off your enthusiasm, so that you are not making the effort that you formerly made. If you will go back into your territories with a definite promise to send in 5 orders each during the next 30 days, this company will no longer be in financial difficulty, for that additional business will see us clear. Will you do it?" They said they would, and they did. That incident has gone down in the history of the National Cash Register Company under the name of Hugh Chalmers' $1 million shoe shine, for it is said that this turned the tide in the company's affairs and was worth millions of dollars. Enthusiasm knows no defeat. The sales manager who knows how to send out an army of enthusiastic salespeople may set his own price on his services, and what is more important even than this, he can increase the earning capacity of every person under his direction. Thus, his enthusiasm benefits not only himself, but perhaps hundreds of others. Enthusiasm is never a matter of chance. There are certain stimuli which produce enthusiasm, the most important of these being as follows. 1. Occupation and work which one loves best. 2. Environment where one comes in contact with others who are enthusiastic and optimistic. 3. Financial success. 4. Complete mastery and application in one's daily work of the 17 laws of success. Number 5. Good health. Number 6. Knowledge that one has served others in some helpful manner. Number 7. Good clothes, appropriate to the needs of one's occupation. All of these 7 sources of stimuli are self-explanatory, with the exception of the last. The psychology of clothes is understood by very few people, and for this reason, it will be here explained in detail. Clothes constitute the most important part of the embellishment that every person must have in order to feel self-reliant, hopeful, and enthusiastic.